Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Comic Boom Crossover. I'm one of your co-hosts, Jace.
And I'm Comic Boom Rocky. Sorry, man, I'm sleeping.
All good. So, everybody, just a quick bit of housekeeping before we get started. You know, we talked about before when we did the Future State, it was 10 days after, and some people didn't like that. They thought it was too long. So we started doing our DC Spotlights on Fridays. And what we noticed, the first week we actually released it on Tuesday, the day the books came out, and you guys loved it. And we got a lot of engagement, and everybody was really happy. And then we thought, well, maybe that's a little too soon. And we moved it back to Friday, the day we were doing the Future States. And we noticed that, like, the engagement really dropped off. So we're going to go ahead and start just dropping them on Tuesdays. So I know it's spoilers, and I know some of you don't get a chance to pick up your books on Tuesday. Maybe you're not reading them until the weekend or what have you. But look, there are a segment of you out there who are engaging with these books the first day they come out on Tuesday, and you want to know and you want to check it out. You read the book and, hey, I'm going to go on YouTube and see what other people think. And so we want to respect that, and we want to be able to give you content. So we're going to start dropping the Tuesday spotlights on Tuesdays, the same day the DC books hit. Now, I understand for some of you, you may not want to listen to it on Tuesday, and that's great, but at least it's there for the people that do. So don't worry, we're still going to have some DC content on Fridays. We're going to be calling it the Flashback Friday, and I'm going to be continuing to review the books that lead up to Dark Knight Death Metal and You're the Villain and all that kind of stuff. So if you're wondering how we got here to Infinite Frontier, you want a refresher, go back and check out those Flashback Fridays, talking about some older DC books on Friday. But going forward, we're going to be releasing the DC spotlights for the new books on Tuesday. So just be aware, there are spoilers. So if you haven't had a chance to read them, you probably don't want to check out DC Spotlight Tuesdays until you've had a chance to read them, unless you don't care about spoilers. And then by all means, listen in. And of course, we're still going to be doing our regular New Comic Wednesday episodes, which are spoiler free, where we'll talk about the books in much more general terms. And that one's just for is just audio. Whereas the DC Spotlight that Comic Boom and I do, obviously, is on YouTube as well. So all that being said, we're going to talk about four of the books that are dropping today as you hear this, which would be March 16th. And we're going to start off with DC's newest anthology series, Superman Red and Blue. So this is one of those series kind of in the theme of, like, Batman Black and White or Wolverine. I think it's called Black, White and Blood, where it's a limited palette, right? Like Batman Black and White, obviously everything's in black and white. Wolverine Black, White, and Blood is everything is in black and white and red for blood. Well, with the Superman Red and Blue, everything is red and blue. And then obviously you kind of have to throw the white in there just for negative space. So it's different shades of blue and red. And I don't know how I really feel about it, to be honest. I kind of feel like it takes away, and it just seems like DC is trying to jump on the bandwagon of these sort of monochromatic or dichromatic, or in this case, trichromatic colors. I don't mind it when a colorist does it for a panel here or there because it's really impactful. But when you do a bunch of stories like that, it kind of loses its specialness, you know? So I just don't know that it necessarily does much for me. Like, just give me, like, I love the idea of a Superman anthology, don't get me wrong, but just give me regular colored art so I can, you know, appreciate it. And if you do want to do a few, like maybe one story here or there, or a few panels in a story with limited colors, then yeah, it's going to have more impact. So that's just kind of how I felt about it overall. I also didn't feel like overall the stories really grabbed me, but let me go ahead and give the creative team, and then we'll talk about each of them, and we'll talk about the individual art as we go through as well. So like I said, Superman Red and Blue. It's got a couple of really cool covers. I think the Gary Frank cover, and then there's another really cool cover by Lee Bermejo. There's a third cover by Yoshitaki Amano that I kind of felt like, I don't know, it was almost like a little kid drew it. And so that one was,
yeah, I thought it was awful, that one. I thought it was a kindergarten kid with a bad crayon set. It was like, it was just really bad. I thought that one, I know which one you're referring to.
Yeah, so I'm showing it here on the screen. And yeah, I just, like, when I showed that to my wife, actually, and I said, it looks like a kid drew it. And she literally thought I meant a kid drew this. And she's like, oh, it was like 9, 10 years old. That's pretty good for that age. I was like, no, you don't understand. This is actually a published cover from a DC comic.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good.
Yeah, it wasn't really good. But anyway, there's several stories, obviously, an anthology, as I said. The first story is called Untitled. It's written by John Ridley, art by Clayton Henry, colors by Jordy Belair, letters by Dave Sharp. Second story is called The Measure of Hope, written by Brandon Easton, art by Steve Lieber, colors by Ron Chan, and letters by Clayton Cowles. The Boy Who Saved Superman, written and illustrated by Wes Craig, with letters by Darren Bennett. Human Colors, written by Dan Waters, illustrated by Danny, with letters by Dave Sharp. And we finish up with The School of Hard Knock Knock Jokes, written by Marguerite Bennett, illustrated by Jill Thompson, letters by Troy Pateri. So we'll go story by story. The first one that's written by John Ridley, I found, like, I really like the art. I really like the line work by Clayton Henry. It's done really well. And even though the colors are, this is one of those cases where I think just having the limited palette does sort of work, but I think the story would have worked just as well in full color. The problem that I had with it, and it is an interesting story. Superman basically goes to this kind of third world country, Eastern European country, and he's walking through an old, like POW camp. And we learned that he was there trying to help out the country during a natural disaster. And somehow this tiny country in Eastern Europe somehow had the ability to create sort of a gaseous form of low-grade kryptonite that took away Superman's powers. And he was actually a prisoner in this POW camp for 8 months, and he was tortured. And that's the part where it really sort of falls apart for me. Even Superman unpowered, he still has some level of invulnerability, and I think he escapes sooner than 8 months, and he's not tortured. Clark Kent is smart enough to figure a way to escape. That's number one. Number two, we learn that Batman eventually is the one that helps him escape, and I would totally buy that too, but guess what? It wouldn't take 8 months, and I understand that in order for this story to have the impact that it does, that's how long he needed to be there. It needed to be this extended period of trauma. But I'm sorry, the other heroes of the DC universe aren't going to let Clark Kent or Superman rot away in a POW camp for 8 months. It's just not going to happen. He's too important to the world, stopping other, you know, disasters and being kind of the moral center of the Justice League. I read that, and then it just fell apart. It fell apart.
Didn't you get the sense that I would have loved to have read that story where he was tortured for 8 months? I would have loved to have read that story more so than the story surrounding it.
Yeah. Well, and it could have been, it didn't have to be 8 months. It could have been maybe they got their hands on some real kryptonite, so he really was weakened, because that makes more sense than this country with limited resources being able to make gaseous kryptonite. They don't really have any infrastructure or whatever. And maybe be able to torture him just, you know, for a few hours or even a day, you know, while Batman gathers a strike team together to go and rescue him. And it still could have had the same level of trauma or impact. You know, he could have befriended somebody else in the camp that got killed, you know, and it's more like psychological or emotional baggage that he's carrying around because he wasn't strong enough at that time to save the kid or the man or the woman or whoever. But to say he's there for 8 months, and then basically Clark Kent goes back and he, you know, times have changed, and now this country's more affluent. They're sort of they've managed to have a recovery and become like this financial, kind of like a Switzerland thing where everybody does all their banking and finances through them. So now it's a place of prosperity, but it's more like the 1% there, you know, are preying on the backs of the, you know, the more peasants that sort of civilization and culture that's still there. And he the whole reason he's going there is to interview this guy, Kozlov, who was actually the person that was in charge of the camp, the one that tortured him. So he sees him as sort of his demon, right, that he's carrying around. So he's going back to interview him and try to shine a light on all the bad stuff this guy's done. And, you know, through the course of their conversation, he kind of asks him, well, what if you ran this prison camp or whatever? And Kozlov just kind of shines in, well, we all made mistakes. We got to move on. The past is the past, kind of thing. And there's even this scene where Superman or Clark talks about, I don't know what I was hoping, maybe that he'd break down and be haunted and torn up with guilt for the things he caused, or he'd be completely unrepentant and give me this excuse I needed to kill him. Like, there's a scene where Superman is like shooting his heat vision at this guy, just this regular human guy, and like killing him. I'm like, no, that doesn't, I don't care how much trauma. No, doesn't happen. But ultimately the guy, like I said, he kind of throws up his hands and says, yeah, we need to not talk about the past. And so then we hear that Clark is going to, you know, kind of write an expose, and this guy's going to be, he's going to pay the price through like bad publicity and all that kind of thing. And after he writes the story, he wonders, will anyone care enough how he made his money? It's on the backs of these other people. Yeah, I care. No matter the consequences, I always care. And there's something going on where some police are heading to some emergency. And as he's saying this, I care, he goes running into an alley in this city in, I don't remember what the name of the country is, but anyway, in the city to go and change into Superman and go help with whatever emergency is going on. So even though he, Lubania, that's what it's called. Even though he had suffered all this torture by using his powers in Lubania at one point, it doesn't stop him from being Superman. He's still going to go and help when something's going wrong in Lubania. So I don't know. I love the art. I thought it worked really well. This is probably the story that best illustrates using a limited palette can really work. But the story itself, it didn't do much for me. Like Rocky said, I rather would have seen him, you know, spend 3 days in the camp and hear about the rescue mission and, you know, his futility once he is rescued with not being able to stop these kind of human atrocities. And why does man, you know, visit this kind of horror on themselves and that kind of thing. That would have been a more interesting story. This, it just doesn't work for me. 8 months, come on. Gaseous kryptonite from a poor Eastern Bloc country. No, that doesn't work. So I don't know. Maybe John really doesn't have, I mean, we covered his Batman extensively during Future State, and we had problems with that. Maybe he just doesn't understand these characters as well as one might hope. You know, he wants to tell the stories he wants to tell, and it's hard to do when you have a character that's so well established and you have different ideas. So I don't know. For me, story-wise, it just didn't work, but I thought the art was great. What did you think, Rocky?
Well, one of the things that stood out about this story was the missed opportunity, because I actually think that the potential for this story was really, really big, because when you think about it, you mentioned the timeline, 8 months passing. That's not what bothers me. The writer could have easily said a month or 2 weeks. The shortfalls of the story would have remained the same regardless of the time frame that Superman was there. I'm more interested in the manner in which Clark Kent finds some measure of being able to forgive his enemies. The idea of atonement, forgiveness. And I think that's what John Ridley was trying to show, that Clark Kent, that Superman, the human side of him does fantasize about using his heat vision to kill his enemies, and especially one that has spent so many months torturing him. I'm sure he felt the same way. This story could have been told with Lex Luthor on the other side, but instead he tried to humanize it using real world villains that we can, you know, more easily relate to, like a dictator of a Middle Eastern or foreign country. So in that respect, it did pull me in at first, because I was curious, you know, how is Clark Kent going to react to this? And what I found a little bit, I felt that John really played it really safe. The first way he played it safe, and I thought this was cowardly, is that this is an untitled story. This is the only story that doesn't have a title.
Yeah.
I thought that was very interesting. This thing cries out for a title. Call it Atonement, call it Forgiveness, or something related to that, the internal struggle that Clark Kent has in the story. And I could probably come up with one, but I was a little surprised that it doesn't have a title, because I think that could have helped maybe sell the story a little bit more. And the other thing is just the fact that I would have had Clark Kent just showed a little bit more humanity, a little bit anger, let a little bit of humanity and anger seep out as a reporter. I mean, this story is, just to be clear, nobody in the continuity of this story, the dictator does not know that he's Superman. So he would have been forgiven for being a little bit more aggressive as a reporter and maybe losing his temper a little bit. I would have liked to have seen just a little bit more humanity in it. But so I'm going to give John Ridley some props for coming up with an interesting idea, but I'm going to detract some points for, I don't think he went far enough, and shame on him for not giving it a title.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I would rather have seen the, you know, you say the human side, and it's funny, you know, we think about like in terms of Spock, that's always a character that comes up. He's half a Vulcan, half human, and his human side is emotions, whatever. Superman I get what you're saying, the human side, because he was raised by humans, but he's 100% Kryptonian. Doesn't mean he doesn't have emotions. Doesn't mean he doesn't get mad. But rather than having that anger manifest itself with a, you know, a panel where he thinks about losing his cool and using his heat vision on this guy, like you said, I'd rather would have had that anger come out in a more natural way with, you know, more aggressive questioning, you know, like, well, I know somebody that was in the camp that was tortured. You know, what do you say to that? Just don't just let him off the hook saying, oh, the past is going to be the past. So, yeah, I agree with you. It 100% missed opportunity. Well, let's move on. Second story is called The Measure of Hope. Again, Brandon Easton, the writer, Steve Lieber, artist, Ron Chan, colors, Clayton Kellon, letters. This one, I hate to say it because I, you know, again, nobody sets out to make a bad comic, but we've seen this story before with Superman, and it's been done. Not only has it been done before, but it's been done better. And so this is basically a story of somebody that Superman had met in the past, whose mother had overdosed on, I take that back. So basically this guy had written to Superman in the past many times asking for help because his mother was a drug addict. And Superman had never had the chance to go and try to help. And when he finally does go to help this guy, he goes to the guy's at his mother's funeral. It's too late for her. And so Superman feels really guilty. So again, it's like, you know, a social issue. Brandon Easton's a writer of color. In the story, the woman who overdoses is a person of color. So we get it. You know, we know that people who are on the lower economic tiers are more likely to suffer from, not that it's exclusive to them, but they're more likely to suffer from addiction and these kind of problems. And it's a problem bigger than Superman. It's a problem that superpowers can't fix. And even the mother herself, when her son discovers she's using it, she makes no excuses. You know, she says, I've made bad choices. I've tried to quit. I can't. I take full responsibility for these terrible choices. Please promise me you'll never touch this up. So it is realistic in that way. It didn't go down too many paths of stereotypes and tropes. But again, it's this idea that these societal issues are problems that are bigger than what Superman can solve. But again, I just feel like it's been done before and it's been done better, where it's a little more poignant. I don't know. Maybe that was the point of Brandon Easton, to make Superman's never felt more impotent in a way, right? Like, not only are you too late to save her, like, you're showing up at the funeral, dude. Like, that's not even, it's kind of gauche, you know? Like, I mean, I know you're Superman, and I'm sure that the son appreciated you saying, hey, I got your letters. I came. Obviously, I'm too late. Like, give the guy time to grieve. Maybe show up a few weeks after the funeral, you know? Hey, I'm sorry for your loss, kind of thing. But to show up at the funeral, I don't know. It just didn't work for me. And the art, I thought, was just okay. I've seen much, much better from Steve Lieber. And maybe that's because of the color work here. The three colors really didn't work for me here. I even thought the coloring, I had to go back to the first couple pages to see, wait, this is the same guy? Because the guy whose mother died, we see him as a grown man. And his coloring looked so different from when he was a child. I didn't realize he was a person of color on the first few pages. And then when you go back and you see him as a kid, it's clear that he is. So I didn't think that worked either. Like, why is he colored with a reddish hue as an adult? He's colored with a bluish hue when he was a kid. Like, yeah, this one was probably my least favorite. I didn't care for it at all. What were your thoughts, Rocky?
Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree with you, but this was, but my disagreement, I come across it honestly, because I just, I've actually, you know, not to overshare, but I've worked with people who deal with addictions before, and I've had some loss in my life from suicide, and this one did tug on my heartstrings a little bit. I think this is a lesson that, even though it might have been done before, Chase, I think having a nice little reminder is a good thing. And Superman realizes here that no matter how powerful you are, you can't make other people's choices for them. And what is very telling here is that even the mother, when she spoke to when he was a young man, he recalls the mother even admitting that these are my choices. I take responsibility for them. But at the end of the day, she's still human. She's still flaws, and she still makes mistakes. And sometimes those mistakes lead to the end of your life. And that's just, you know, it's a very harsh lesson, but I do know that in various circles for treatment of addiction, that when, one of the things that they tell people who treat people that are dealing with addiction is that when you lose somebody who's going through addiction, when you're trying to help somebody, but you lose them and you're unsuccessful in helping them, you have to tell yourself one thing. And what's that one thing? It's one word. Next. It might sound harsh, but it's actually a sign that you can't help them all, but you keep trying. You go to the next one. You keep putting it forward. You keep trying to help people. That's what Superman does here. And this is the reminder here. And that's what I like about, here's a guy who's lost his mother to addiction, but he knows that it's not Superman's fault, but he respects Superman for being there and at least being cognizant of it and showing up at the funeral. Might seem a little late, but you can't help everyone. And so this is definitely one of the most real, you know, for me, this was a story that spoke to me. And I have, you know, for that reason, I liked it. And because of that, because I was so involved in the story, I thought the coloring actually kind of worked here. Even the way that the colorist even though he used sort of an off shade of red, you could tell it's a black person near the end there. It was a clever use. I thought it was a very clever use of coloring and a very intelligent use of coloring that just worked for me. So yeah, I just, I'm glad I read this one. It's my favorite in the book.
Wow. Well, yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I will say one thing that was refreshing, even though we've seen these kind of stories before. The one for me that always, this type of story where Superman learns a lesson, you can't help everybody. It's one that I actually just talked about recently during this last holiday season. Because this sort of harkens back to that, right? The mail, the once a year mail issues that they used to do around Christmas where Superman goes and reads his mail. And there's one where Superman reads the story or reads a letter from a kid who's, dad is dying of cancer, and he shows up at the hospital just moments after the man had passed away from cancer, and is trying to talk to the son and tell him, you know, it's that same lesson. Superman can't save everybody. You know, so these superpowers are limited. And in that story, much like many of these types of stories that have been done before, there's anger at Superman. So to your point, Rocky, the thing I did like about the story was the fact that this guy doesn't fall into that trope. This guy whose mother passed away, like you said, doesn't blame Superman and realizes, just like all those years ago that his mother told him, yeah, she owned it. It was her choices. She was weak. Please don't make the same mistake. So yeah, it wasn't all bad. It just, I don't know. It didn't speak to me. So anyway, next one that I actually really enjoyed, The Boy Who Saved Superman, story and art by Wes Craig, letters by Darren Bennett. So this one's interesting. Superman basically goes up against this really powerful villain that we have never heard before. And he ends up getting, rescued by a kid in this, I think it's an African country. And then oh, so many years later, this same kid has grown up and become a pretty famous photojournalist and is applying for a job at the Daily Planet. So first of all, the art is spectacular, especially the title page. It's very Eisner-esque. Superman is, again, he's fighting against this kind of, I think it's an alien entity, and he's been sort of knocked out. He's laying on the roof of this building. And in kind of the rubble and wreckage that's strewn around him, it spells out Superman. So really kind of cool whenever an artist can incorporate the title into the art, which Will Eisner used to do all the time. But other than that, it what was really refreshing about it, it was a cool story about not giving up. And this kid is very determined, and you can see why he eventually grew up to become a successful journalist. Because he doesn't give up in the story. He helps Superman eventually defeat this alien. But the coolest thing about the story was the fact that Superman, Clark Kent, at the end, he sees this guy who's getting, you know, who's applying for the job at the Daily Planet. He knows that he was that kid from back in the day. And Superman himself has a little bit of hero worship for everything this kid has accomplished. Because he didn't give up back then when he was trying to help Superman. And with no superpowers, he's, you know, become this photojournalist who's sort of given his life to, you know, trying to shine a light of truth on things that have that the world needs to know about. And so it was kind of interesting to see Clark Kent get a little starstruck, you know, little hero worship. He says, you know, he's a big admirer of his work, and that the work this guy's done, Abdi is his name, the work is incredible. So I thought it was a really, really cool story. So what were your thoughts about this one, Rocky?
I really liked it, and I particularly like the use of colors as well on this one. And it's, as I'm going through it, it occurs to me that obviously the advantage of calling this Superman, red and blue is that they're using different shades of red and different shades of blue. And it's right. quite clever how they kind of, they go from sky blue to almost purplish blue to Superman blue. And the same with the different red, with the reds as well. And on the flashback scene where as a young man, he's saving Superman and he loses his hand in the process. It's actually completely crushed. And it's really good. And what kid doesn't dream? Like when I remember as a kid, what kid doesn't dream of teaming up with Superman or helping out a superhero when you're young? And this is exactly what this kid is doing. And he obviously doesn't have any superpowers. And this is really just, it's a little bit of wish fulfillment for the reader. And also it's a nice callback because in the future, as you said, when he ultimately accepts a job at the Daily Planet and he shakes Clark Kent's hand with a mechanical hand and he's got a good grip. And of course he says, so do you Clark. It's bringing Clark. It's not only bringing Superman down to the human level, but it's elevating us humans to Superman's level with that handshake at the end. And it really brought the story full circle. And I thought it was really good. And it was a way not only of, uplifting and a good story for a good memory for Superman, but it also is a good feel good story for those of us reading it. And again, I thought the art was really, really, really good. I really thought that the color palette really worked well for this.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Up next is Human Colors, Dan Waters script, Danny art, Dave Sharp on letters. So this one starts off in black and white, and there's an imp, not Mrs. Piddalick, but another imp from the fifth dimension who comes and steals all the color from the world. That's why it's in black and white. Not only does he steal all the color from the world, but because all the color has been taken from the world, nobody is even aware that colors existed. Like when he talks about colors, like, well, what are colors? Superman himself, what are colors? Like they don't even realize that colors used to exist as far as they know that everything has always been in black and white. And so Superman, once this imp is confronted by Superman, he realizes, oh, maybe I shouldn't have taken these colors. I've sort of taken what's special about the world. Everything's gone a bit gray. And not only have the colors been taken, but because the colors have been taken, humans don't seem to have emotions anymore. They don't laugh at things that are funny. They don't get angry in traffic jams. Everyone's kind of silent. And he doesn't realize, the imp says, I didn't realize what a difference colors made in your lives. You're not tickled pink or things don't happen out of the blue. And I guess I didn't realize it would mess up your dimension so much. So he gives Superman the colors back. He goes, here's all the colors. They're safe and sound in this box. Let them out if you want to. It's up to you. But I will warn you that a world with colors is far more complicated than a world without. And so Superman, he doesn't just immediately open the box and let the colors out because he's not sure that he should, right? It's an unknown to him because he doesn't remember that colors exist. So he goes and talks to Batman and wonders what he should do. He talks to Lois and wonders what he should do. And eventually after talking to Lois, she goes, well, why don't you just let back one or two colors at a time and see what happens. So first he lets out red, which, it's the color of warmth and passion and love and all those positive things, but it's also the color of anger and blood and that sort of thing. And so because of that, just the one palette, and he has mixed results, he decides to let out a second color, which is blue, the color of sadness and funerals and wailing, but also the color of music and the color of water and the color of blood inside people's veins, making us alive. And so once he does that, he realizes that, hey, yeah, maybe we should have these colors. It's important to have these colors and to have these emotions. And it kind of reminds everybody of what it means to be human, both the good things and the bad things. And by starting off with red and blue, it sort of also reminds us of who Superman is and brings back the sunrise is how the story ends. So I liked it. I thought it was interesting and certainly a cool way to take advantage of the fact that you're using a limited palette. This one was pretty good. And I thought the art was really spectacular, especially as the colors, this color start to come back. And Danny, the artist, D-A-N-I, handles both the line work and the color work. And I thought they did a really good job. So yeah, that one was pretty solid, I thought. What about you, Rocky?
I chuckled at Batman's comment when Superman talked to him about it. Batman, he said that I don't remember these colors. It could be a prank. And then he wondered if maybe Batmite had something to do with it. And yeah. That was comical. I'm also reminded of that wonderful preview of Man of Steel where Jor-El is uttering those words. In time, they will join you in the sun. Yep. And that's what the story is. And really, the sun brings obviously the sunlight. And of course, it's light that gives us color, because colors make up the spectrum of light. And it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful symbology throughout. And you have already alluded to it, the love, the anger for red, music and sadness for blue, and et cetera, et cetera. And the idea that Superman even felt a little bit guilty, maybe that he was forcing this on humanity, when in fact he's just permitting and just opening up humanity to a new way of looking at things. Because when you look at something, you know, how you look at something, it changes depending on your own perception. And again, it was just a beautiful story in that way. It was well told. And in fact, all these stories really, that's one of the strengths of, if you're not into long soap opera storytelling, that's one of the advantages of these anthologies, especially for Superman, is that you often get these types of human stories, because, you know, the first one we're dealing with a dictator, then the second one we're dealing with a measure of hope and dealing with, you know, the average citizen who loses a mother to drug addiction, and we had a boy who saved Superman and dealing with that. And now with these human colors, we're dealing with the way Superman looks at the world and bringing us colors and enlightening humanity. There's definitely a theme in this entire issue. And again, it's another one that works. And as you said, it started off black and white, and it ends up illuminating obviously the color palette, but also having something to say about Superman.
Yeah. It's interesting. You bring up that point about all these stories coming at Superman from a human interest aspect. And I guess it sort of makes sense, right? When you start talking about it, it's an anthology, a lot of these people, maybe might be coming, I don't know for sure, but they might be coming at it from the perspective of, hey, if you're only going to get to tell one Superman story, and, you know, so much of Superman is about those ideas of hope and redemption and the best things about humanity. So it's interesting. There's no real like classic superhero stories here where, you know, Superman's, you know, fighting this villain or that villain or whatever. So I wonder going forward if we might get those, or if it's going to stay in this sort of wheelhouse of these more emotionally focused stories. So I don't know. It remains to be seen. But anyway, the last story, School of Hard Knock Knock Jokes, Marguerite Bennett, writer, Jill Thompson, artist. So I think this is the best color work in the book. Jill Thompson shows both the line work and the colors. You almost don't realize that she's only using reds and blues. That's how well she uses them in different shades. And it's basically a story of not actually Superman, but of Clark Kent as a young boy. And he's starting out in school, and there's a little girl who seems to be sort of isolated from the rest of the kids. And Clark's worried that he has to hide his superpowers, and if he's going to be accepted. And once he is accepted, he's real happy about that. But then he worries that if he goes and tries to befriend this other girl who seems to be having all of the things that he was worried about, you know, can't make friends. Everybody seems to ignore her. And he's kind of torn, you know. I mean, he's only 5 years old, and he's thinking, but if I go over there with the girl that everybody's sort of, not befriending, are they going to sort of turn on me and they're not going to want to be friends with me anymore? Like if they're shunning her for a reason, and I go and hang out with her, maybe they're going to shun me too. And he doesn't want that. He wants to be accepted, just like all of us do, you know, especially at that age. And then he talks about it with his parents at night, and they don't tell him what to do. They just say, you know what the right thing to do is. And I love that. I love this sort of reminder of what great parents Ma and Pa Kent were. I think Zack Snyder could do with having this story read to him over and over 1,000 times for the rest of his life. Because this is how you get Superman. This is how you get somebody whose moral character is the best thing about him, rather than that garbage character of Pa Kent that we got in the Man of Steel movie, who is encouraging Clark to hide and, you know, let me die, don't save me, because better to hide. Ridiculous, just garbage. Not who Superman is at all, not who the Kents are at all. So this is a great reminder of who Ma and Pa Kent are as characters and how Superman became Superman. You know, it's so much more than just his powers. It's the way he was raised, to the point where they don't even have to tell him, you know, do this. So you know what the right thing to do is. We've shown you love. We've raised you the right way. And we trust, even at 5 years old, they trust him to do the right thing. And of course, Clark does it. And it ends up being great. And then the rest of the kids end up realizing, oh, you know, they kind of didn't realize they were kind of ignoring this one little girl. And she becomes a member of the group as well. So a great story to finish up this anthology, reminding us of the best things about Superman and Ma and Pa Kent being proud of Clark for the decisions that he makes. And, you know, they have faith in him that he's going to do the right thing. Unlike, you know, Kevin Costner in the Man of Steel movie, who's, you know, just full of fear. It's not the way you raise a Superman. So, what were your thoughts about this last one, Rocky?
Hey, it's a great John Kent story. I mean, we get a nice young John Kent story. It's not technically in continuity, but it's a type of stories that I love. And I think we all loved because it's not a young John Kent story. Sorry. It's a young Clark Kent story, right. But it reminds me of a young John Kent mm-hmm. story, which we're not getting anymore in the mainstream DC universe. And I would love to see actually more in the mainstream DC universe. I'd like to see more flashbacks of young Clark, of young Clark Kent, especially in the context of him talking to a young John Kent, quite frankly, but of course that's not happening. But yeah, what's there to say? I love Marguerite Bennett, and I've got a place in my Marguerite Bennett. I met her in New York City Comic Con in October 2019. She was also very nice. I've got a bias toward liking her because she was very polite. She sent my daughter a signed autograph of a DC superhero, it was DC Bombshells, and she liked it. My picture of my daughter on Twitter. So I'm totally biased. So I it's a feel good story. I really like it. And yeah, there's really not much to say. I mean, I would, you know, frankly, you know, I started off here when we started talking about this whole anthology that being perhaps sounding a little bit negative of it, but you know, quite frankly, at the end of it here, upon reflection, all of these were feel good stories. And if you want to just enjoy yourself and have and feel good, I mean, I the enjoyment that I got reading these stories, especially now reviewing them, you know, I'd recommend this. Some of them have some tropes, but at the same time, I think we need reminders every now and then because we're drowned out so much in soap opera storytelling, especially right now in Superman. I mean, if you're tired of the mainstream, and you and I have had our criticisms of the mainstream Superman and Action Comics titles, even right now during Future State and post Future State, this might be a good recommendation for somebody who just wants to feel good Superman and be reminded as to why they like the Man of Steel.
Yeah. Like I said, the only thing I worry about is if it stays with just these human stories and we don't get any action stories, that could turn some people off. Like I love the emotional stories as much as anybody, but I also like, you know, action stories for Superman as well. So I guess it remains to be seen what we'll have going forward. But I think overall, yeah, if you like Superman, you're going to like this issue, despite my wish for them to just give us a Superman anthology. It doesn't have to be limited color palette. even though I think for the most part, the art works here, some stories better than others, but definitely the last story, it works great. So, all right, well, let's move on to the next book. It's Justice League number 29. Justice League number 59, the first of the Brian Michael Bendis era. He is the writer. Art is by David Marquez, colors by Tamara Bondalon, and letters by Josh Reed. So, I'll let you kick this one off, Rocky. What did you think of the first Bendis Justice League?
I'm reminded of something that Bendis often says in his interviews, and he says that he likes to work with the artists. And while you can take some issues with that depending on who the artist is. I will say that there's no question that I think he worked with David Marquez in this issue, because we get some beautiful sequences here. He definitely worked with, he gave David Marquez an opportunity here to really show off some of his abilities to draw action scenes. This issue actually reminded me of the David Marquez that drew Civil War II. Brian Michael Bendis and David Marquez, they worked with on Civil War II together, and they also worked on The Last Defenders at Marvel, which are collaborations that I remember quite fondly. Leaving aside the issues with the narrative, the art was spectacular, and the art here is just fantastic. Now, having said that, the downside of working with an artist to allow an artist to show off their art is that sometimes the narrative suffers. And being objective here, I actually think that this is actually Bendis does make one notable mistake or screw up, which I'm sure if I don't mention, you will. But I will say that not much happens here narratively, but it's beautiful to look at. This is one glorified long action scene. A villain from another universe invades the Earth. Black Adam and the Justice League take him down. They track his energy signature. It's untraceable. But wait, just a few months ago, they managed to find a similar energy signature, and that's Naomi. Surprise, surprise. And Black Adam confronts Naomi at the end. That's basically the story here. That's the substance. The rest of the issue consists of action scenes and one could say perhaps unnecessary dialogue. But, you know, clearly Bendis is working towards sort of building, trying to build some character moments. My big question here, and this might be a minor nitpick. I'm not sure if I think this is supposed to be Barry Allen as a member, as the Flash in this issue, because he's wearing a lab coat, but he's drawn with red hair, so he looks like Wally West. At one point, Wally / Barry, whoever it is, asks Kendra if she knows if there's any other information in the Thanagarian database. I think Bendis doesn't understand that Kendra is not Thanagarian; she's in fact human. Scott Snyder made that same mistake in Justice League, so perhaps Bendis can be forgiven. But I was a little unclear there. It might have been an artistic mistake. Maybe the colors was supposed to draw Barry Allen, because the Flash here is wearing a lab coat. So the only Flash who wears a lab coat at times is Barry Allen, and yet he looks like, clearly he's Wally. He's not drawn with blonde hair. But if I let that go, overall, this narrative, you know, it's a little slow going, but this was action-packed. It was beautifully drawn. It was easy to read. Beyond, other than that minor nitpick, I actually enjoyed this. And I'm overall, again, between the art and the narrative, I enjoyed it. I'm going to stick around to see what happens here. And I don't know, man, what do you think? I thought I was going to hate this, but I actually found it. I'm going to stay on board for at least another issue.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the boat, rowing right along with you. I expected to hate it, and I didn't. You know, I always try to go into things with an open mind. I certainly went into Bendis' Superman run with an open mind, hoping for good things. But you're right. There, in terms of forward momentum and how much chunk of story we get, it's not a lot. But the David Marquez art sort of makes up for that, because it is beautiful to look at. Clearly, Bendis is sort of establishing the foundation here. The fact that, you know, Black Adam is going to be much more on the heroic side, which we knew from everything that happened in Future State and what we saw in Infinite Frontier. And so those kind of, you know, seeds are planted here. We know Naomi's going to be on the League, whether we think that's justified or maybe she should be over at Titans Academy earning her spot in the Justice League. You know, whether that's how we feel or not, the fact is DC editorial, maybe because she has a show in development, is you know, pushing forward, and they want her to have a higher profile. And, you know, she's a Bendis creation. So I will be curious to see what her voice is like here, because I did like the Naomi mini, but I think David F. Walker actually scripted it. And so, you know, he wrote it with Bendis, but how much of the success of that and how good it was, how much of that was Walker, how much was Bendis, you know, remains to be seen. So I didn't dislike this, but I feel like it's too soon to say. So I'm on board for another issue, if only for the art. And I guess we'll see. I thought the second story, was much more compelling, which for those that, that aren't aware or don't realize, haven't listened to the podcast in the past, we've talked about how the fact that Justice League Dark is no longer its own separate title. It's now going to be a backup, not quite a co-feature. It's a few less pages than the regular Justice League series is going to be. But, you know, you're paying more money. And I'm not to the point where I'm willing to give DC any money for Bendis's Justice League work after this one issue. But at least I'm not saying I'm never going to give them money. Like, because that's where I was. I was like, no way am I giving DC any money for Justice League if Bendis is writing it. Now I'm like, yeah, let's wait and see. Maybe I will. In the meantime, I'll keep reading my my press preview copies. But I thought the backup story, Return to Caledonia, written by Ram V, art by Zero Manico, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., and letters by Rob Lee. I thought that was much more compelling. We're getting Merlin returning. Big spoiler there. The big bad, it looks like, is going to be Merlin, which that's what we saw in the Justice League Dark story in Future State, that it was Merlin, which, you know, when you talk about sort of the story and the myth of King Arthur, Merlin was on the side of heroes. And the DC universe, he's always been kind of walking that fine line. And it seems like in recent years, more falling on the side of being a villain than anything else. So I thought, you know, it's Ram V. He's writing Justice League Dark. I loved his when he took over from for James Tynan. And he's picking up right where he left off. He gives a great voice for John Constantine. I think he nails Zatanna. I think he has a good understanding of who these characters are. We see Jason Blood show up. So it really seems like he's putting all the pieces in place to get us to the point of that story we were reading in Justice League Dark, which I didn't really care for that much. It was so dark and cynical and dystopian, but we know the way that ended was with Dr. Fate kind of sacrificing, but then at the last moment telling the demon Etrigan, hey, you're going to go back in the past. You live in all time. I'm going to give you this knowledge now, and maybe you can use it in the past to avoid this future. So if that's what we're going to see here, Etrigan sort of foiling Merlin's plans, it could be interesting. I'm not the biggest Etrigan fan, but I love Constantine. I love Zatanna. I'm a big fan of Ram V. So if anything, this is you know, the reason I would pick up the Justice League book was more, man, I wish Justice League Dark was its own title, because I'd still be buying that. But if Bendis's Justice League gets just a little bit better, and the Justice League Dark continues to be as good as it is, then maybe I will be spending my money on this title. So, what do you think about the second story, Rocky?
I love this. I love this narratively. This was a better written story. There is so much substance. There's so much story cram packed into this
in fewer pages.
Exactly. And it's very, very interesting. I not only read this three times, I wanted to read it three times because I wanted to understand what was going on. And this is actually extremely well written. Ram V, and boy, I'm going to be complimenting Ram V. I love this Swamp Thing. I love his Dark. I love his Justice League Dark. I'll be going to be talking about how much I love his Catwoman in a bit when we get to that. Man, this guy's hitting it out of the park. He's got an independent comic book coming out, I believe in April, called The Many Lives of Layla Starr. And so, I mean, this guy is firing on all cylinders. I think he's trying to duplicate James Tynion's success. And I think he's well on his way to doing that, man. Between him and Tynion, those two are largely responsible for why I think DC, I'm enjoying DC so much. But this is great. I love the fact that Merlin is really the bad guy here. I mean, Merlin, you know, he's not content to trust mortal realms to mortals any longer. He converts the sword Excalibur back to a stone and a gem, and he says, I'll drag this world to its destiny, kicking and screaming if I must. Mm-hmm. What does he mean by that? We're not sure, but we know that, as you said, in Future State, in Dark Justice League Dark Future State, that Dr. Fate makes a bargain with Merlin to spare the demon Etrigan if he works and becomes the sort of like a person that can tell the future for Merlin, because only Kalina Sir can use the Helmet of Fate to see the future, and Merlin can't. And so we know that happens in the future. But as you said, the past is not written in stone for the demon Etrigan. And what's fascinating is that in the 7th century and in the year 1994, an angel came down in the 7th century and a demon came down in 1994, all hearkening about this war between the angels and demons. And of course, this what happens here is John Constantine and Zatanna end up sort of stumbling upon that. And they know that something's coming. They know that something's coming and that it has to do with Merlin, and there is a reckoning to be had. And for those of us that are interested in the long-term history of overall history of the DC universe, I think that it starts here. You alluded to it. I've alluded to it. It's in the comic. It's in Future State. That really, I think that what's going to prevent us from the horrible future that we see in Future State is going to be playing out in Justice League and in Justice League Dark. And the one thing, as much as I've complained about having these backups sometimes, this is the one situation where part of me is glad that Justice League Dark is shoehorned into a Justice League comic, because I think ironically, Justice League fans should be reading Justice League Dark, because I think it is the more important story, quite frankly. And if that means shoehorning into Justice League is going to get the attention that Ram V deserves for telling this kind of story, so be it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So, all right, well, let's move on to the next Ram V book. As you mentioned, he's also writing Catwoman, which I've been singing the praises of for quite a while. So issue 29 is out today as well. Written by the aforementioned Ram V, art by Fernando Blanco, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Tom Napolitano. I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but man, I'm going to say it once again. If you are a fan of Michael Mann movies, Heat or Collateral or Manhunter or any of those, this is a must-read comic, because that is the feeling I get of watching a Michael Mann movie. You know, big fan of the 80s, Miami Vice with Jamie Foxx, and Colin Farrell's another one of his movies. And that slick feel where the scenery itself is a character. He captures that so well. And he's continuing to give Catwoman the most authentic voice I think Selina Kyle has ever had. Like this for me is the attitude and the way that Catwoman would hold herself, with some confidence and a little bit of edge, and not some kind of outright villain, which she hasn't been for a long time, especially with Tom King wanting to put her in a relationship with Batman. But she's not necessarily somebody you would consider a hero either, you know. She cares about other people, but she also cares a lot about herself. So it's finding that balance and giving her an authentic voice that I think makes her so compelling. Plus, we're introduced to a new villain that has a really cool look. She almost has like a honeycomb like look to her on her costume, some kind of electronic or technological armor that she wears, where it's just black with this yellow honeycomb pattern on it. And then she's got, you know, like a hoodie on top of that. And she's using blades.
Does she have a name yet? Does she have a name?
No, I went through and I looked at it several times.
I couldn't find it. Yeah.
They refer to her as the Asset several times. And they say that she has some inherent metahuman abilities, which are allowing her to sort of use this ability or compound or whatever that they're harvesting from Poison Ivy, that the sort of the nefarious organized crime organization is like harvesting and trying to create these drugs from Poison Ivy herself. And then we find out that this is tying in to more of the things that we saw in Future State, because we see what's his name, Simon Saint. We see his name, that one of these people who is running these experiments on Poison Ivy is answering to Simon Saint. And so this is all tying in with the magistrate and all that sort of thing. And so it's high action, a lot of great scenery. There's a scene early on with Catwoman in a bathing suit at the pool, where the cop that she sort of has been going back and forth working with and helping out, and she kind of lays down the law for him. He gets a little too familiar with her, kind of acting like they're buddy-buddy, or she's his CI, his criminal informant, and she kind of sets the record straight. But all I could think in that pool scene was, it's like right out of a Michael Mann movie. It's just, it's so spectacular. And I just keep going back to the voice of Selina that Ram V gives her, the way he writes her, it's tone perfect for me. It's my favorite sort of voice, and personality, if you want to use that word instead of voice, my favorite personality that Selena has ever had. It feels the most authentic and, kind of the most realistic when you talk about who Selena is in terms of, she is a criminal, but a lot of times she's doing the wrong thing for the right reasons, and still wants to look out for herself. And, you know, she's always been sort of a Robin Hood like figure. It's not like she steals all this money and goes and retires somewhere. She always comes back and she wants to protect the orphans that live in the nest, corner of Gotham City and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, this book is just firing on all cylinders. The Fernando Blanco art is spectacular as well. I mean, I couldn't get that really cool cinematic Michael Mann feeling if it wasn't for the art as well, that he does so well, these cinematic, layouts and the long panels that stretch all the way across the page. So, I'm loving Catwoman. Like, as soon as I saw Catwoman was like the regular Catwoman was returning, I was really excited. Not that the future state Catwoman was bad, because it was Ram V with Otto Schmidt art. So that was one of our favorites of future state. But this is what I was looking forward to. Let's get back to the regular story that Ram V is crafting here. And I wasn't disappointed at all. It picked up right where it left off. Catwoman, I never would have thought. I mean, I'm not the biggest Catwoman fan. And I only got back on Catwoman because I had read the Joelle Jones stuff. And then I kind of fell off of it. And I only got back on because it had tied into Joker War. And I got back on with, I think, issue 25 was a Joker War tie-in. And I think that was also Ram V's first issue he read. And I read issue 25. I was immediately hooked. And it's one of the titles I look forward. Probably I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say it's a DC title I look forward to the most reading every month. Like, as soon as I get the preview books, if it's Catwoman week, that's the book I'd read first. That's how good it is. So what are your thoughts, Rocky?
Well, I wonder, part of me wonders if this is going to tie into Harley Quinn, the Harley Quinn in the backup feature of Batman Urban Legends, and where she's looking for, we know that Harley Quinn is looking for Poison Ivy. Mm. I'm wondering if time-wise this is going to sync up, and if some point in the future we can expect to see Harley Quinn in the pages of Catwoman, since obviously Poison Ivy is someone that's being sort of experimented on through machinations of Simon Saint.
Well, that's the Gotham City Sirens, right? The original, it's these three.
That's exactly right. So this has all the hallmarks of something that can become very, very enticing. My favorite line of dialogue was an exchange between the detective and Catwoman, where he says to her, "You set half the Gotham City docks on fire." And she asks, "Is that all I set on fire, detective?" I mean, the innuendo and the dialogue here is just excellent. This plays out like a great detective thriller, where of course you got the rapport between the sort of like the grifty looking, rough looking detective who dresses badly with just cheap jeans and a t-shirt, with the sexy woman getting out of the pool. And she's, like you said, looking absolutely gorgeous. And then of course her sister stating things sarcastically in the background. I mean, again, Ram V, he just nails this here. Again, I'm just so impressed how Ram V can go from telling deeply horror-like stories for Swamp Thing to tell detective, fun, almost James Bond-like stories here in Catwoman, and then go and tell a Justice League Dark story with medieval magic and mythology. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm impressed. I mean, the guy's brain, I don't know what he's taken, but I'd like to, you know, I wish he'd give a couple of the pills he's taken to Bendis and some other writers, and then we'd DC would really be firing on all cylinders. But I mean, I like this. And let me give a shout out to Jordi Belair on the colors, man. I mean, when I don't know how she does it, but even the villain here with, we don't know who the villain is, this asset, but even the way it's colored, like it almost looks like a honeycomb or like a beehive, the yellow lines, the bright gold colors. This is visually just beautiful to look at. I mean, this is very well done. The title of the story is called Bad Habits, and wow, opposite of reading it, because I want to get into the habit of reading more of this story. That's all I got to say. This was a joy to read. I read it twice again because I wanted to, and I want to know how things end up. There's that one page where it shows the city skyline I think that you referenced. It shows Catwoman sort of jumping across the city skyline. The number of colors that Jordi Belair uses, absolutely gorgeous. It looks like it's in Chinatown of some kind, or maybe that's forgive my ignorance. I think that's Japanese, but just really a genuinely gorgeous. I mean, the settings here, I think we've got a penthouse top suite. We've got a city skyline. We got the Gotham docks overlooking with the skyline of a bridge. I'm not sure what city this is in, but this is really good and great crime scenes. I mean, we didn't even mention the Riddler, and I mean, Enigma here. I mean, Ramvi nails his voice just perfectly. And Enigma ends up getting shot by another villain who has an agenda that we're as yet completely unaware of, or we're getting hints of it. This, again, full compliments to Ramvi, and, you know, another reason to buy a DC comic.
Yeah, I was going to actually mention Riddler as we're winding up here, because I almost feel like here's Ramvi taking advantage of the rogues gallery of Batman, who many people feel has the best rogues gallery in all of comics, Marvel, DC, or otherwise. And it feels like all we ever get in Batman is Joker, 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 or Bane, 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 or Riddler, Riddler, Riddler. Why not mix it up? Why not give us multiple? Here we have Poison Ivy and Riddler and this, you know, asset, this honeycomb. And then the other guy that likes to quote Bible scriptures, who has been hired to assassinate Catwoman, but apparently wants to play with her a while first. So yeah, I mean, this is great. There are a lot of moving parts, a lot of pieces, and Ramvi is pulling all the right strings. It's fantastic. So let's move on to last book. This may be the one that's most highly anticipated this week. It's Nightwing number 78 from Tom Taylor with art by Bruno Redondo. We have colors by Adriana Lucas and letters by Wes Abbott. So wow, was this an incredible book. I'll let you go first, Rocky.
Yeah, again, what is this? 2 or 3 weeks in a row and I got a smile on my face reading DC Comics. Man, I hope they keep this up. Well, everything, I think all of us were hoping that Tom Taylor, I think some of us, I know I was surprised that Tom Taylor chose Nightwing. I was expecting him maybe to write, I don't know, Superman or some other title. Wonderful surprise that he's writing Nightwing. This is, you know, of all, Nightwing has had so many different writers on him over the years and so many different approaches. And yet Tom Taylor somehow makes this feel completely fresh. You don't need to know anything about Nightwing. The flashback sequence here of a young Dick Grayson trying to protect the young Barbara Gordon from bullies and then confronting and just the way he ties it into the present, where his relationship with Alfred and Alfred being the father figure. And this is literally, that was the first 1, 2, 3, 4, the first 5 pages alone are, if I would have paid the cover price for the first 5 pages alone. And that's before the epic cinematic Nightwing leaping into the night, part one. Just beautifully done. And talk about a beautiful city landscape by Redondo, showing there with Nightwing going through that cityscape. I mean, compare that to Fernando Blanco's Catwoman doing the same thing in her city in the comic book we just reviewed, Catwoman. Man, just fantastic. And I can't believe I'm saying this. At one level, if we're sitting here and we're describing this to people listening, this is... a lot of the story just involves Nightwing saving a puppy. and how can you would think, how can you make a story about saving a puppy be entertaining other than maybe just being a little bit of a laugh fest? But he manages to pull it off, and you get to know Dick Grayson. And while at the same time, you see that is there's such a powerful juxtaposition between Nightwing saving a puppy and being a guy goes against bullies, juxtaposed against, you know, Blockbuster and the and Merrill corruption in the city of Bloodhaven. And, you know, right away you've got Blockbuster, you know, snapping the neck of one of the mayor's underlings. And so right away, you know what the stakes are. Right away, you know, you got Nightwing in a new in Bloodhaven, dealing Bloodhaven again. We know we got his classic villain, which is Blockbuster, who he's fought before. But everything here, I note here that this Blockbuster looks different than in previous incarnations. And I like this new look that Redondo gives Blockbuster. Blockbuster has in the past been he's had this stupid little hair thing. And anyways, I like the artistic designs of the characters here. This really works. Mare Zuko, of course, is there's a connection with Mare Zuko to Dick Grayson's past. So again, the rapport between Barbara Gordon and Nightwing, Dick Grayson, I love it. And I'll let you take it from there, man.
Yeah, I mean, I have three small dogs. So obviously I'm a dog guy. So, you know, having Dick Grayson, it kind of mirrors that first five pages we get, right? Where he's saving a young female classmate from bullies. And then he's doing the same thing when he's saving this puppy. Cause these punks running around Bloodhaven, they have no reason to be bullying this puppy other than they can. And he like, no, that's not going to go down on my watch. And so that's interesting. And clearly Tom Taylor's also establishing that he's going to be respectful of what's come before in Nightwing. This isn't a complete departure. And that's, I feel, where Blockbuster comes in. And so, you know, he's still going to be pulling from things that have happened in the past and being respectful. So it's kind of a nod to longtime Nightwing readers that, hey, this isn't a whole new Nightwing. This is still the Dick Grayson that you know and love. We know Barbara Gordon is going to be a huge part of the series going forward, which, I mean, I know Dick Grayson, for a lot of people, he's their favorite DC character, and he sort of embodies hope in the same way that Superman or Wally West does. And we talk about hope in DC Universe a lot, because Rocky and I are of a similar opinion that we think it's a very crucial component. It's part of what gives DC its charm. And Rocky made the point either last time or the week before that when we say hope, 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 it doesn't mean that everything is sunshine and daisies, but it means that at least once in a while, you have a happy ending. You have things line up correctly. And the reason these heroes keep fighting is because that's what they're fighting for. They're fighting for that happy ending, even if it always doesn't work out that way. So when you start talking about Dick Grayson and being, this beloved character, I think also, as much as a lot of people, Teen Titans fans, loved when Starfire and Dick Grayson were together, when you start talking about that charm and who you want to see together, I know I love Barbara and Dick as a couple. I think that they're they have the potential to be one of these great comic book couples, like Peter and Mary Jane, or Oliver Queen and Dinah Lance, or Superman and Lois. Like it's that potential. And I'm glad that Barbara's going to be a big part of the story, because I want to see that developed. I want to see that relationship. I want to read about that relationship. And so I'm glad that Barbara's going to be part of the story. And I'm also interested with the other things that DC is doing with her, in terms of taking her out of the costume in the pages of Batman and putting her more behind the chair, a little bit more of Oracle, because she is so brilliant. And she can do so much more as Oracle than she can as Batgirl. You know, Batgirl, maybe she can stop three or four crimes a night, whereas Oracle, she can kind of be the eyes and ears of the whole superhero community and do so much more. And she's so brilliant. And so I just think she's a complex character. And I think bringing her to the pages of, especially because she doesn't have her own title right now, bringing her to the pages of Nightwing, I'm all for that.
I would just add to what your comments about the other major change here, which I think has a lot of potential, is the fact that Dick Grayson is a billionaire.
Well, he's really rich. Yeah. So, I was going to mention that. As cool as it was to see Barbara show back up, as heartwarming as it was to see Dick Grayson save this puppy, and even though he plans on turning it over to a shelter, even Barbara's like, Dick, we know you're not going to go take this puppy to a shelter. You saved the puppy. You now have a puppy. But then at the end, he receives this letter from Alfred, right? And it's such a heartfelt moment, reading the words from Alfred to somebody he considers a son. And certainly Dick Grayson considers Alfred like his father, you know, a second father, more so than I would argue than Bruce was a father to him. Alfred was the one that really raised him and instilled in him the values. And maybe that's why Dick Grayson has always been a lighter character in terms of his emotion. He doesn't have that edge, that thirst for vengeance that Bruce Wayne has. And I attribute that to him basically being raised by Alfred, much more so than being raised by Bruce Wayne. And so basically what we're told at the end is Alfred, you know, he didn't lack for any funds, right? Like when the Waynes died, Thomas and Martha Wayne, he inherited a bunch of Wayne stock, and he didn't need to do anything with it, right? I mean, he lived at the mansion and drew his regular salary, and everything was provided for. And so he just kept that stock and whatever money he had and reinvested. And yeah, you wouldn't know it, but the guy was a billionaire, and he's left Dick Grayson all that money to do with whatever he feels that he should do. And Alfred talks about how he can't think of anybody else that he would trust with this incredible resource more than Dick Grayson. And it was just such a touching moment. I got a little choked up reading it, and like the words that Alfred puts in this letter and the emotion that Alfred conveys, it's so authentic to how Alfred, if he was a real person, would feel about Dick Grayson if he's a real person. So kudos to Tom Taylor. You know, I was talking before about how Dick Grayson is such a great character and everybody loves him. Dick Grayson's not even my favorite Robin. My favorite Robin is Tim Drake. And so Dick Grayson's always kind of lived, like, I've been sort of indifferent about him. I like him well enough, but I've never been that invested. I've been a Nightwing reader off and on here or there, just kind of depending on who the creative team. I've never cared so much about Dick Grayson as I do now just from reading this one issue. Like, I am all in. I picked this up, or I read this because it was Tom Taylor and because we're going to review it for this episode, more so than because I was interested in reading about Dick Grayson or reading Nightwing. But after this one issue, Tom Taylor has made me more of a Dick Grayson fan and made me care more about Nightwing as a character than I ever have previously, ever. And like Rocky said earlier, there's been so many different and great creators that have been on Nightwing over the years that may surprise a lot of people. But that's where I'm at after reading just this one issue. And it has so much to do with just the page of Dick Grayson reading this letter from Alfred. You know, I mean, he's sitting on his fire escape. Barbara's there next to him, and he's reading this letter, and he's finding out, hey, I'm a billionaire. And not least of which, why I'm interested is, so what is Dick going to do with this money, right? Like, he's always been there to try to help out Bloodhaven rather than Gotham. But he's always been sort of trying to scrape by on a shoestring budget. And now all of a sudden Batman's over here in the poorhouse in Gotham City, and Dick Grayson's going to be the one that has all kinds of resources. So I don't think Tom Taylor's going to do this. But the one thing that might make me less interested in this story is if Dick went the Batman route and started using this money to create a bunch of gadgets and Nightwing drones or that kind of thing. I'm not interested in any of that. That's a Batman thing, to have all kinds of tech and gadget. I want Dick to stay grounded and to stay emotional, because I think those are the kind of stories that work for Nightwing. So yeah, this was an incredible issue, and the artwork is stunning. It is so good. Both the line work and the colors. I would say that for me, this was a 10 out of 10, and I don't give 10 out of 10s. I just don't. Like, a perfect comic to me is like as close as you can get is probably a 9. because I can always find something. Oh, you could have done that better. You could have done that. For me, this is the best comic I've read in years. I don't know how you possibly could have improved this. I just thought it was perfect. So 10 out of 10 for me, just absolutely spectacular. Without a doubt, best comic I've read in a long time. Anything else to add, Rocky?
Not really, man. You summed it up very well.
Okay, everybody, in addition to the books that we talked about, there are a few other DC titles coming out this week. We've got the Batgirl Returns Omnibus hardcover for $100. We've got Batman versus Ra's al Ghul, number 5 of 6. That's the Neil Adams written and drawn title that I have stayed far, far away from. We also have the Sheriff of Babylon trade paperback and Truth and Justice, number 2, which for some reason we don't get preview copies of. So those are some other DC titles that you might want to be on the lookout for, in addition to the books we already talked about. Anything you want to plug, Rocky? Anything you got coming up on the channel?
Yes. What came out last week, I am going to be doing an extensive review of Grant Morrison's Earth 1, Volume 3 of Wonder Woman, which I quite enjoyed. I think it's hilarious. It's controversial. It deals with sex wars, the matriarchy, the patriarchy, and Ares, and Maxwell Lord is Ares, the god of war versus Wonder Woman, and all the Amazons and all the multiverses, and just the chaotic fun. And I'm surprised not more people are talking about it, quite frankly, because I think there's a lot of very interesting tidbits there to mine from a storytelling perspective, and I thought it was very entertaining. So I'll be doing that review in the next 7 days.
Yeah, Earth One, Wonder Woman is the only Earth One books that I haven't read of Earth One, just because I'm not that big of a Morrison fan. But so many people have said good stuff about it. I think I got to get around.
It's very grounded in the Golden Age Wonder Woman. The first 10 issues of Wonder Woman take all that to heart, and that's what Grant Morrison double downs on. So it might seem unfamiliar to a lot of people, but it, in fact, it's very much beholden to the Golden Age of Wonder Woman. So even if you're familiar with the Silver Age and Modern Age of Wonder Woman, you might be a little surprised to learn that a lot of the ideas are very old. They're just before our times, because right. Again, he loves the Golden Age Wonder Woman, and boy, does it show.
Yeah, Morrison, he likes to mine that stuff. For the Comic Source, everybody, we have another issue out today, Tuesday, as you're listening to this, our regular X Tuesday episode, which covers House of X number 6, closing out that miniseries from Jonathan Hickman. Obviously, tomorrow, our new Comics Wednesday episode every week, spoiler free. And then, as I mentioned, we'll still continue to do some DC spotlights on Fridays, but it'll be Flashback Friday. So this week, we're going to be covering Dial H number 2, Freedom Fighters number 5, Heroes in Crisis number 8, and Justice League number 22. Again, all books are a little older leading up to Dark Knight, Death Metal, and Year of the Villain, and all that kind of stuff. So be sure and check it out. Be sure that if you are a follower or listener to the Comic Source and you haven't gone over and subscribed to Comic Boom on the YouTube channel, definitely just go over there, do a search for Comic Boom with an exclamation point, smash on that subscribe button, smash on that like button, and check it out. Maybe sometimes you get tired of just hearing my voice and you want to actually see us. You know, I share pages, sometimes the visuals that we're talking about as we're talking about them. And obviously you get to see my beautiful face as well as Rocky's handsome ruggedness. So so that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. As always, thanks to my partner in crime, Comic Boom, for joining me. And these DC spotlights are just, they're so much fun partnering up. You know, I do so many of these episodes kind of solo. And now that Rocky and I kind of have this regular thing going, it's so much fun to just bounce these ideas off each other. We don't always agree, like we didn't agree on Superman Red and Blue, but that's okay, because not every comic story is for every other person. So we want to thank you for listening or watching, as always, and we will talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.